Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The sublime music is by the great Johannes Brahms, and it is from one of his most beautiful works, his German Requiem. And it is always a very, very special treat when one can experience the Brahms German Requiem in person, in concert. And such a pleasure can be yours this weekend, in a busy weekend when there are all kinds of musical offerings to enjoy. Certainly one of the chief offerings that you should really consider is to experience the Brahms Requiem at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We have with us in our studios today two members of the music faculty at Parkside, Dr. James Kinchin and Dr. Alvaro Garcia, and they are sort of the choral and orchestra men, respectively, of the music department there, and both are having a hand in the preparation for these performances. Two performances, I believe, and spell out for our listeners when those performances are.
They are Saturday, April 29th at 7:30. And Sunday, April 30th at 3:30, both performances in the splendid acoustics of Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the UW Parkside campus.
What a great place to make music and to hear music. And I can well imagine just how gorgeous this work is going to sound in that beautiful space. Now, I understand, Dr. Kinchin, that you're going to be conducting this, so you'll be in front of the chorus and orchestra. So, Dr. Alvaro Garcia, you were telling me you have a relatively easy job this weekend. Relatively easy.
Yes, for me it's always easier when I grab my home instrument, in a sense, and my viola, and I get to play with the orchestra. It's something that I enjoy really much, be part of the music and be involved with the masterwork that Brahms wrote. Hmm. In this case, but yeah, I truly enjoy playing with my own orchestra. You know, I get to conduct all the time, but for this time, it's just I come down to the reins, or as I told my orchestra the other day, I finally got promoted to perform in the viola section.
Ah, there you go. Although I assume that you played some, or maybe not, but did you play some role in the preparation of the orchestra to play this piece?
Yes, the first initial early rehearsals I would have was conducting, preparing them in the sectionals and so for the arrival of our guest conductor, Dr. Kinchin. And in such preparation, we look at all the intricacies that Brahms had. So when Dr. Kinchin arrived, we were doing all full orchestra at that point with him.
And you are nodding your head emphatically. You're probably grateful for his able assistance when it comes to this not small matter of the orchestra being ready to tackle this kind of work.
Beyond words. He did just an amazing job in preparing them and getting them ready, laying all of those essential technical foundations there. So that when I came into the first rehearsal, I could actually stand in front of them and begin sharing with them my vision of the music. So he did a really amazing job with that.
Great. Yeah. Dr. Garcia, explain who this orchestra is. I mean, exactly what this ensemble is sort of all about.
The community orchestra at UW Parkside is just an open orchestra. For the string, strings are welcome at any concert, any time. Winds are by invitation because there is not that many parts like, for example, a band will have. So for those, we have to invite them to come in. But it's all voluntary orchestra, and we just get together to make music as for the joy of it and to provide an outlet to many musicians here in our area. Also, it's an intricate part of the orchestral program at Parkside, as our students also, our orchestral students, will merge with them to create a full symphonic orchestra. In that case, we'll prepare also the same type of repertoire, which will be our standard college level, repertoire for some of them who are looking to the music as a professional world.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. How many of them would you say have played the Brahms Requiem before, of these particular players who are gathered together for this particular orchestra? Do you have any idea?
That's a good question that I haven't asked, but I'm assuming that very, very few or almost none. I would say for sure none of my students. But out of the community players that we have, very few would have played these, if so.
Right. So it makes it even a bigger thrill whenever you're confronting a masterwork like this for the first time.
Certainly for Parkside will be the first time.
The very first time Parkside's done Brahms Requiem.
Yes. Yes.
Cool. And we haven't yet talked about who is singing. Who comprises the choir singing this amazing work?
Well, the choral forces are coming from several different streams, which has added its own challenge to the preparation from the choral side. We have members of the UW Parkside Master Singers, which is our campus community choir. We also have members of University Chorale, which is our elective choir, most of whom have always been students.
Mm-hmm.
And we are joined also by some alums who I'm just real thrilled are coming to sing with us, and members from Milwaukee Choristers, which is the community choir that I conduct in Milwaukee, and they're all coming together. But that's meant that I've had to fashion essentially four different paths of preparation to get everybody there. But what a thrill it's been to pull those people together and to hear not only the musical results and the vocal sound, but also to know the just incredible love that people have invested in preparing what is, for most of them, the most challenging choral thing that they've ever done.
Hmm. We haven't yet talked about the background of Brahms's composition, and for that matter, we haven't even yet spelled out the way in which this is, in a sense, a rather odd requiem, or certainly not a requiem mass in the standard sense of the word. Let's start there. Explain the way in which this is not a mass like the Verdi Requiem or the Mozart Requiem In what way is this a different requiem from any of those other equally famous works?
Well, I mean, the first most clear intrinsic part of it that you can recognize immediately is that number one is not in Latin. So as a requiem, you will follow the structure of the requiem Mass of the Morning with all the specific Latin words to it in the Catholic service. This one didn't follow that path. This is clearly what we could consider a Lutheran sort of requiem. But even aside from that being Lutheran, Brahms was very specific of what pieces of the scriptures he used for, and I believe he used the Luther Bible for that, in which he will pick and choose what passages of the Bible he will use out of his own view to really create a vision of the Requiem that it was he described himself as a humanistic Requiem. It's a Requiem about humanity. It's a Requiem about victory. It's a Requiem about joy. It's a Requiem about almost to say life in a sense, not a Requiem about death.
I'm trying to remember, and perhaps Dr. Kinchin, you know the circumstances around which Brahms wrote this. I know it's not towards the end of his life. He's a relatively young man.
He's a relatively young composer. And I think as I began to study this and prepare to prepare it, if you understand what I mean as a conductor, that was one of the things that I don't think I fully understood and that really was a surprise for me. Now, I think we'll have to say this about Brahms generally. He was very, very capable of sort of incubating musical ideas and having them inside of him for a long time. I mean, so for example, look how long it took him to come up with his first symphony and how long that had been sort of percolating.
And right, years and years and years. Years. Yeah.
So we suspect that one of the first impetuses for this requiem was in 1856 when his newly found and enthusiastic mentor, Robert Schumann, passed away, and that may have been an emphasis. And it's known that Schumann himself was expecting to write at some point some kind of requiem. We don't know exactly the detail of that, or whether he ever committed anything to paper with that. And Brahms most certainly would have at least been aware of that. Then we fast forward to 1865 when Brahms's mother passed. And he was so devoted to her. And we think that that really is sort of the main catalyst for this composition. He began it in 1865, and he continued with it, tweaking it and doing revisions of it. It was performed in a six-movement form in 1868 in Bremen. And then he added, almost immediately after that performance, the final movement, which becomes in the sequence now, movement number 5, for soprano, solo, and choir, which to, even though I don't think Brahms ever admitted it, but to those of us who listen to it, it's probably most intimately connected with his thoughts and his memories of his own mother.
Interesting. I did not know that the six movements came first, and then this other movement, which is exceptionally beautiful and tender, comes just after that. Then, do you know if this work, right from the start, was regarded as a great masterwork? I mean, was it, at least for the most part, properly understood and appreciated in the immediate moment?
Almost so. And so I'll hedge a little bit. So the very first time we hear it at all, three movements of it are presented. And in what we've come to know as movement number 3, which has this wonderful but very dense fugue at the end, and it's all over a D pedal. The timpani participates in that. the timpanist in this performance, we understand, just pounded away at the drums and drowned out everybody. and so people hissed at that. And so that was not a very auspicious start. But it was not. It didn't take very long in its history for it to catch on, which also was a surprise for me. That in the span of time between about 1868 and 1875 or so, there were 70, almost 80 performances of the Requiem.
Wow!
Done. And it didn't take long for it to get over here. 1877. It was performed in New York by the New York Oratorio Society for the first time. So it caught on. It needed a little bit to get traction, but then it caught on, and it was really, really well received and accepted, and became a part of our choral orchestral canon.
I think what is interesting too is the fact that there was a lot of. Arguably with the clergy at the time, because the clergy obviously was expecting to hear Requiem in its pure sense. And this
normal with a Kyrie and
with
the Gloria.
With a Kyrie and the Gloria. Yeah. Or either if it would have been a German Requiem, something to do more directly attached to the Lord's wisdom or the Lord's word. But Brahms, because he was so picking and choosing the text, he kind of avoided that. He kind of avoided citing the Lord directly, which at the time, the music director of the Cathedral of Bremen, I think it was Karl Rheinfaller, he was cautioning him, like, careful, Herr Brahms, you may have problems with the clergy here because this is not as could be viewed as a true Requiem in a sense. So that created some controversy initially there too, so that he had some problems starting with one's the performance one, also the text one, but as Dr. Kinchin pointed out, it didn't take long to catch on and be extremely successful later on.
It's a big piece, and I know that to do when you do the whole thing, it's over an hour long. Are you planning on? I think most of the time it's done straight through without interruption. Is that your plan for these performances?
Essentially, yes. We'll have a small interval just so that there can be some retuning, and we'll go off to catch our breath for just a moment. The principals will, the conductor, the soloist, but pretty much without break. There will not be a planned intermission.
Right. And I always feel like, I don't know how much Brahms was a particularly practical man, but I think this work works beautifully in that respect. I mean, you wouldn't want an intermission in the middle to kind of take you out of the moment, and yet it lasts, in my opinion, it lasts exactly the right amount of time. In all the times I've ever experienced the Brahms Requiem, I don't even once looked at my watch and kind of waited for it to be over. It's just like, time, in a sense, just stands still and loses its meaning because it's just such a beautiful work.
Yes, indeed it is.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Dr. James Kinchin and Dr. Alvaro Garcia from the music faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. They are going to be presenting two performances this weekend of the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. One performance Saturday evening at 7:30 and the second performance Sunday afternoon at 3:30 in the beautiful Francis Bedford Hall, Concert Hall at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Gentlemen, I'm going to give each of you a chance to request a sample played from maybe a movement that you especially love and give you a chance to kind of talk about it and explain what's being sung maybe and also why you love it so much. Dr. Kinchin, let's put that question to you first. And give me the number of the movements,
yeah,
just so there's
sure.
No.
I'm sitting here laughing because you asked such an impossible thing. my favorite moment in the Brahms Requiem is the one that I'm listening to or conducting at the moment. But let me set this up. And also, I want to tell you, we've got two outstanding soloists who will be coming. Brian Leeper baritone, who has done Messiah with us twice and also did the Beethoven Ninth, the Ode to Joy with us. It's a wonderful voice that brings together, in my opinion, good resonance and heft. You know, and we're just so happy to welcome our own alumna, Jennifer Hansen, to the soprano. And she sings so beautifully. And, of course, she just recently completed her graduate study in voice at UWM. And so we're just really thrilled to have her come back and sing.
That's terrific. That's going to be great.
Now, parts, I don't know. And you may not want to do the whole of this. But this would be number six. And this is that moment where people who analyze the Requiem say, well, Brahms, because he didn't do the traditional Latin liturgy, this is the equivalent of his Dies Irae. And it's true that he just sort of sets all of the guns loose in the orchestra and the choir is singing full bore. But rather than people cringing in fear because of this day of wrath and reckoning that is to come, people are instead sort of pointing their finger in the face of those eternal enemies of humanity, death and the grave. Death, where is your sting? And grave, where is your victory? And this happens perhaps about a couple, 3 minutes into it. The baritone solo does some interaction with the choir. Behold, I'll tell you mystery. And then tells us that death is swallowed up in victory. But that's such an amazing moment. It just comes alive.
Well, let's hear it. Okay. If I'm reading this correctly, we're going to be hearing none other than the Welsh-based baritone Bryn Terfel. And let's listen to the first few minutes of the sixth movement of the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms.
Thank you.
For the trumpet shall sound and the death shall be raised. A moment from the Brahms Requiem, the German Requiem, the sixth movement, and stunning music by Brahms. And of course, as we're listening to it, it just reminds me too of how challenging this score is for both the orchestra and for the singers confronting it. So in some ways, when you take on this work, you're taking on its greatness, and you're taking on everything that makes it challenging, right?
Yes, you were asking before for us to pick a movement. Of course, here we are picking the same movement between the two of us. So you kind of leave me with the impossible question. But you know, as a string player. When I play this, and then I compare when I play the Brahms symphonies, it's just so much similarity about the symphonic world, how he treats music and treats the string world. And the moment that we were cutting off there in the sixth movement is when I was saying that now is when the strings are having fun. Through all this joy, victorious moment throughout the entire movement towards the end. But if I were have to choose then another movement, I mean, I could pretty much choose all the movements. It's one that is still the piece takes, what, hour and 15 minutes? And when you are playing, it doesn't even seem like that it is hour and 15 minutes. It just works so naturally into your bow, into your playing, that it becomes very refreshing to be able to play the whole thing. But if I were to choose, as I said before, a movement, probably the second movement would have been the one that attracts me, not only because of its character of almost funeral march, which is not, but it seems somewhat that in the music reminds us so much of that. Although the dual modality of going major, minor, minor, major all the time is what it kind of creates that big waves of refreshing air into this funeral march, in a sense. And you know, it's funny how the text starts first, "For all flesh, it is as grass." You know, it's just kind of reminding us our mortality, in a sense, but in the same token, telling us that, but be patient within yourself, right? There is more to it. It's not as simple as it looks. And reminding us too that the Lord is with us at all, every single step. So that music that is like a funeral march, that it doesn't end in a dark green place for me. It's a funeral march that it ends in a light, big, open, fresh air, you know, space.
Right. Even though it begins in, as you said, in very somber, stately fashion.
Exactly. If you hear the whole movement, which probably we don't have time today to do that, is when it really develops to that final ending that is also glorious.
Very good. Yes, let's hear at least the opening of this second movement. Denn alles Fleisch es ist wie Gras. For all flesh is as the grass. The grass withers.
Thank you.
It grieves me to interrupt such sublime music. Again, this is the second movement of the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. So, Dr. Kinchin, when do all of the forces gather together for the first time, or has that already happened?
It has not happened. We will do that. Our great convocation will be on Friday evening, and we'll have everybody together. And I think that it'll be exciting. I know the choir is going to be excited to get to sing with the orchestra, and the orchestra, I hope, will be, will also be excited to hear this. All that they have been working on from their perspective as instrumentalists, now joined by the vocal forces to make complete what Brahms has written.
And how many of your singers would you estimate, at least, are singing the Brahms Requiem in its entirety for the first time?
Virtually all of them. Virtually all of them.
Really?
Yes.
So that also probably heightens the challenge of what you've faced in terms of these various choirs and bringing them all to to a place of full confidence and preparedness.
Considerably. I mean, it's been a challenge, and I have, at the same time that I have structured all of the communal things that we do called rehearsals, I have also tried to really, really encourage people to use some of the online resources that are available. Mm. So, for example, you can study the diction and practice the diction using online resources. There are part recordings for every movement, for every voice part, and to ask the singers to invest some of their time and energy in engaging some of those resources as a way of supplementing what we do when we come together. But it's been a challenge.
Mm. A challenge and a joy, I'm sure. So the performances, again, are at the Francis Bedford Concert Hall Saturday evening at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 3:30 p.m., and the public is welcome. Tickets available at the door, and this is a rare opportunity to hear this incomparable masterpiece.
Yes.
We're going to finish out with the last minute or so of the last movement, Selig sind die Toten, Blessed Are They Who Die in the Lord. And again, Dr. James Kinchin and Dr. Alvaro Garcia, a great pleasure to have you with us today to talk about this splendid masterpiece. And best wishes with both of your performances this weekend.
Thank you very much.
Great.
It's 8:48. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program. We are going to be exploring some amazing stories for the next few minutes about some amazing women. The book at hand is called Wonder Women, 25 innovators, inventors, and trailblazers who changed history. But the names are going to be names that will be all but completely unknown to you. At least they were to me. And that's so exciting to read a book which introduces us to incredible women who did incredible things, but whose stories are largely lost to us until that is the good work of Sam Meggs, an assistant writer for BioWare, author of The Fangirl's Guide to the Galaxy, and the author of this new book, Wonder Women, published by Quirk Books. Sam Meggs, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really like the way this book is laid out with five sections: women of science, women of medicine, women of espionage, women of innovation, and finally, women of adventure. At one point in your book, you point out a facet of this that I think is worth talking about. In one reason why we don't know so much about women astronomers, for instance, or women mathematicians, is because there weren't as many of them because there were all kinds of doors shut to women. But that's not the whole story. Your book also points out that in some cases, men actually sort of swooped in and sort of snatched away credit that rightfully belonged to women who had actually come up with a given innovation, and that your book is an effort to right some of history's wrongs. Can you give our listeners one or two examples of a historical wrong in which a man took credit for something that a woman, in fact, had accomplished?
Yeah, that's definitely an unfortunate common theme throughout the book. I mean, so many women throughout history have had amazing accomplishments in STEM that have either been erased by time or they weren't able to take credit for because of their gender or race, or like you say, in this case, stolen by their male colleagues. I think the most famous example of this, which I touch on briefly in the book, is Rosalind Franklin, who discovered the structure of DNA only to have it stolen by Watson and Crick, who we read about in our textbooks now. In Wonder Women, I talk about Alice Ball, who was the first woman and first African-American to get a master's degree from the University of Hawaii in 1915. And at just 23, she invented a cure for leprosy, the first viable cure for leprosy, but died as a complication from the process of that invention. And her male boss was like, I got this invention I came up with recently and took credit for it. And the cure was named after him, which is very unfortunate. Another example of this in the book is Margaret Knight, who was actually in the early 1900s, the woman who invented the machine that makes flat-bottomed paper bags. So when you get takeout food and you put it in a paper bag, she invented that. But she actually she had to sue for her patent after her design was stolen by a man who had seen it and tried to claim it as his own. And his main defense was that a woman couldn't possibly have created something so ingenious. So she won, of course, because she made it, but it was pretty rough.
Right. One of the things that's really clear is that although, for instance, I found this book just endlessly fascinating and revelatory, you clearly have written this book with younger readers in mind, or maybe not exclusively younger readers in mind. But, for instance, when we read at one point that this is a journey into the history of bad as heck babes, that tells us that this is a book written not so much for college professors to read as it is maybe for young girls to really derive some inspiration. Talk about that.
Accessible as possible, because I think when a lot of people think about history books, they think about really boring tomes or textbooks or really things that are really impenetrable to most people or uninteresting. You know, I wanted to approach this topic in as friendly and approachable and humorous a way as possible, because, you know, there are so many injustices done to women and to these women in particular that if you don't laugh about it, you're going to cry, I think, first of all. And also, I think we see a real lack of role models in STEM fields, but science, technology, engineering, and math for young women. So it was really important to me to be able to bring these stories to the forefront so that girls who want to get into these fields, who maybe want to get into coding or video games or engineering, can look at this book, particularly women of color and queer women whose stories are almost never told, and say, look, women like me have been successful at this before. Maybe I can be successful at this too.
I was really amazed that so many of these women were so far back in history. I really wasn't expecting some of these stories to reach really into ancient times, or just back further than I would have thought was possible in terms of women enjoying these kind of tremendous accomplishments. It's quite exciting. I think it would actually be really interesting in terms of giving our listeners some idea of that, to talk about the very first woman you speak about in the book, the first biography in the section of women of science. you talk about an extraordinary astronomer from China from the 18th century. Talk about her and what she accomplished.
Oh, absolutely. Her name was Wang Zhenyi, and she was born in 1768 in China, where women were basically just sewing and having babies and weren't allowed to go to school, and, you know, all that stuff that happened in the 1700s wasn't so great. But she actually became a highly accomplished astronomer and mathematician and poet, and was the first person using a model that she built in her garden using a fountain and some other practical effects, was the first person to discover how eclipses worked. So she made kind of a whole, you know, grade school science experiment that was modeled the movement of the sun and the moon and the earth. And this was while in the West we were still figuring out whether the earth was flat or not. She was like, I know how eclipses work. Meanwhile, in China, this woman in the 1700s figured out eclipses, so pretty impressive.
Right. And you tell us about the protest poetry that she also wrote. I mean, she was a well-rounded woman, and we so appreciate hearing about that. We hear about a Chinese inventor of textile technology who dates back actually to the 13th century. And I'm just really impressed that you were able to uncover such wide-ranging stories spanning so much of world history. What kind of a challenge was that for you to uncover the stories of some of these women who are simply not represented in standard history books or textbooks?
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I think we often have a really white sort of Western view of things. We hear a lot about British and American women, and I do have those women in the book, but we often forget that women in India and China and Japan and Peru and all over the world were also making great strides throughout history and science. So I really wanted to try to make the book as diverse as possible, but it was definitely a challenge, more of a challenge, to dig up those stories, because those narratives in particular are really buried. So I did a lot of research, a lot of looking back into women's history textbooks, history of medicine textbooks. One resource that I really enjoyed using in the States was a website called Chronicling America, which is a newspaper website that archives all old newspapers throughout the States from the 1800s to the early 1900s. So if you want to find out what was going on in your community in, say, 1860, you can go ahead and log on to that website and take a look at the newspaper from that day in history. And it's super fascinating. All kinds of lost stories you can find that way.
Right. I want to make sure that you mention one of my favorite women from this book, Maria Sibylla Merian, a German explorer who set off on an extraordinary journey to South America that is really probably one of the first journeys of its kind in which someone traveled halfway around the world really for the sake of science rather than commerce.
That's right, yeah. So she was born in 1647 in Germany, and she wanted to become a painter, even though women weren't even allowed to use oil paints at that time based on guild rules. But what she really enjoyed painting were insects and the environment in which insects thrived. So she traveled all the way to South America. It was the first self-funded scientific journey ever, because no one would fund a woman to go to America for science. So she sent herself and her daughter, and actually was the first person to catalog a ton of South American entomology. And some of her paintings are still the only examples that we have of insects that have since become extinct. So she was pretty cool.
Incredible. Before we have to let you go, I want to make sure you talk about the appendix at the back of the book, which is called How to Become a Woman of Wonder. Explain what that's about.
I really wanted this book to sort of act as a resource for young women, or women of any age, really, or people of any age to feel empowered to be able to do these things for themselves if they felt inspired by the women in this book. So I just compiled a list of resources and, companies and programs right now that you can get involved in. If you're interested in this sort of stuff, like Girls Who Code, if you want to learn how to be a programmer at any age, you can learn how to make your own video game, all sorts of women exploration groups and things that you can join to either learn or help out women in your community who want to learn.
The book again is titled Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed Histories, published by Quirk Books, and the author, Sam Maggs. Sam Maggs, congratulations on a terrific book. I'm glad we got to talk about it. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, previews of two different musicals that are opening this weekend. The Mystery of Edwin Drood at Carthage and How to...